Welcome to ASCP's podcast, Inside the Lab, where we discuss anything and everything concerning today's laboratory professionals and pathologists. My name is Allie Brown. I'm the Chief Medical Officer at ASCP and one of your hosts.
Hey, everybody. My name is Kelly Swales, and I'm also one of your hosts. I'm an ASCP Certified Medical Laboratory Scientist. I work in the Publications Department at ASCP. Today, we're going to be talking about harnessing pathological response and biomarker testing to improve patient care in non-small cell lung cancer and melanoma. And we've got some guests here that are super excited to talk about it. Sanjay, that's you.
So my name is Sanjay Mukhopadhyay. I'm a lung pathologist at the Cleveland Clinic, which means my job is to stare at lung biopsies and resections down a microscope and then make all kinds of decisions about those biopsies and how to diagnose them. And I'm currently director of the lung pathology service at the Cleveland Clinic.
Hello, thank you for having me on the show. I am Lynette Pino, and I'm an operations manager for laboratory and genetic services for Health Partners. It's a health system based near the Twin Cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. My home base is Regents Hospital in St. Paul, and I am just delighted to be with you today.
Hi, my name is Jim Ondick, and here today to talk about the patient perspective of the topic.
Everyone, thank you so much for joining us. I've got a little bit of housekeeping to get out of the way, and then Allie will kick us off. CME and CMLE will be available for listening to this podcast in the ASCP store. The American Society for Clinical Pathology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide, you guessed it, continuing medical education for physicians. ASCP designates this enduring material for a maximum of 1 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. Physicians should only claim the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. And also, this activity is funded by an independent educational grant by Bristol-Myers Squibb.
So over the past few years, the availability of various targeted therapies for cancer has really increased dramatically. It's a completely different landscape than when I was a resident, which I don't feel like was that long ago. I finished in 2006. I mean, I feel like things have completely changed since that time. So today we're going to talk about two cancer types that are particularly affected by these advances. And those are non-small cell lung carcinoma and melanoma. And then we're also going to talk about some issues that apply to biomarker testing overall, as well as patient perspective.
So I'm just going to throw this out there. I know that we don't have any clinicians per se, but I want to ask you guys how the treatment has changed over the past few years for lung cancer and melanoma.
Okay, so can I jump in, Kelly, here?
Yeah,
absolutely. I can at least for the lung cancer part of the equation, there's been a really big change over the last, I'd say since about 2008-09 to now 2023, things are very, very different. So I recently saw one of the, leading thoracic oncologists with a slide where they said, just back in the 2008-09 kind of time period, what oncologists were talking about in lung cancer therapy of advanced lung cancer, people who have metastatic disease, is they were saying, which is best, chemotherapy regimen 1 or chemotherapy regimen 2 or chemotherapy regimen 3, all of which were equally bad. They didn't work. Survival was in just a couple of months, 2 years, for metastatic lung cancer. So it really was bleak. The news was bleak. Oncologists had to have these really bleak conversations with patients who had metastatic lung cancer. And there was really, it didn't seem like there was much hope. And then starting in, I think in about 2009-10 and then onwards, we started to identify targets, genes that are mutated in lung cancer, and then drugs that can treat those particular genes. And I'll preface this by saying that it doesn't mean that because you have a target that patient is cured. That's not happened yet. But it certainly means that responses are better, toxicities are less. In some cases, overall survival is slightly longer. So those things have, I'll give you an example. So for example, we have a gene called EGFR, the epidermal growth factor receptor. And for that, now we have mutation testing for EGFR for the past decade or more. And so now we have a drug that goes against EGFR and that is effective. So we started with erlotinib, gefitinib. Then we went to next generation after that. Now we are at a drug called osimertinib that works even better and goes into the brain better. So treatment is getting better for that subset of patients. Then we have a mutation called ALK, which is, you know, the anaplastic lymphoma kinase. We have a drug against that. It started with things like crizotinib and has now moved on to things like alectinib, lorlatinib. So there's multiple generations of better drugs against these particular genes. And that has changed the landscape of therapy. Now there's better hope for response, for overall survival, and for less toxicity. And the same thing has happened also with immunotherapy, is now that we have these immunotherapy drugs, pembrolizumab and nivolumab and so forth, now we have an even better hope is that not only do we have responses to therapy in lung cancer, so let's say the patient, instead of living for, I'm just throwing a number out there, let's say 23 months, now they live for 35 months. But not only is that the case, it's that after you stop the drug, in some patients, the response keeps on going even beyond where the drug was stopped. So there is what we call a durable response. And I don't want to throw the cure word out there because it's very, you know, fraught with a lot of hope and expectation. But I would say it's not that patients are necessarily cured, but that we are inching closer and closer towards cure in a small subset of patients who get immunotherapy drugs, who, you know, in those patients who respond and who respond for a long time, you're looking at, you know, very durable responses with therapy. So I think that's my summary of the situation. Targeted therapy and immunotherapy have changed the landscape of lung cancer therapy.
And it's very interesting, Sanjay, when you talk about the different targeted therapies and immunotherapies, because many of those are the same targets that support melanoma treatment and diagnoses as well. And we see the test orders obviously coming in very similar between melanoma and lung cancer for some of these targets and immunotherapies.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think President Jimmy Carter was one of the first like very big success stories where, you know, the public got to hear about this, that he had a melanoma and then he had a metastasis in his brain. And I think they treated him at the time with immunotherapy. And he lived for many years after that. So that, you know, the survival with a thing like that can be extraordinarily gratifying, where before, you know, you would say to a person with metastatic melanoma, there's really not much hope of a long-term survival. So yeah, very much. There's lots of parallels between lung cancer and melanoma, especially with immunotherapy.
So the conversation isn't, I'm sorry, this is what you're going to die of. It's, I'm sorry, we can do all this. You might die of this, but not, maybe not.
Yeah, there's a little bit, you know, for somebody with advanced or metastatic lung cancer, unfortunately, the chances of dying of their disease are still very, very high. You know, it's right. Very, very likely. But there are several things that have changed. You know, patients will live longer. There's a chance that they would live longer with a targeted therapy or with immunotherapy. There are chances that the therapy will be less toxic than chemotherapy used to be. And there'll be chances of responding better to their systemic therapy. So I think there are small advances, and we don't want to say that just because patients aren't curable, that that's not an advance. I still think that that is a very big step forward.
Absolutely.
In treatment, yeah.
I think also too, when we talk about screening and preventative screening has changed so much, I think over the years too, you know, with melanoma, with some of these immunotherapies, especially if it's very early stage, I know Sanjay didn't want to say cure, but you know, there is a real chance that people can live in remission or, you know, not have recurrence. And for lung cancer too, you know, my organization does screening and we have a screening program for people that are high risk for lung cancer that, you know, they would maybe get a low dose CT based on their history. You know, getting to these sooner also helps us be more successful with some of these targeted therapies and immunotherapies.
All right. I want to switch gears and talk to Jim for a moment. Jim, would you mind sharing your journey with us and telling us about your experience?
Yeah. So interesting. Listening to that description, because that was very much, I think, my experience. I was diagnosed in October of 2016.
Say what you were diagnosed with?
I'm sorry. Yes. So metastatic melanoma.
Oh, okay. Okay. So that was back in 2016.
Yeah. I had something, just wasn't feeling, had like swelling and some other weird kind of symptoms, weren't really sure what they were, and went through a bunch of diagnostics, never found anything. Then eventually had a dizziness spell for, you know, vertigo, terrible for about a week. And then they finally did an MRI and they found a brain tumor.
Oh my God.
And then got to looking around and found that it was all through the mediastinum. and then into the lungs. But yeah, they did the surgery on the brain tumor and then, you know, rehab and all that stuff. And they started me, I think, so that was latter part of October of 16. And then went through several rounds of radiation because every time they would do an MRI, they wanted to start me on a clinical trial, which was Devo and Yervoy, and didn't end up qualifying for the trial because the brain tumors kept popping back up. Every time they do an MRI, there'd be another one.
It's like one of those whack-a-mole gopher things, right?
Correct. Yeah. So eventually got through that and then started the Opdivo and Yervoy, and then ended up having a hemophagocytic syndrome as a result of that. And that was right after they had ceased those. They had switched me over to, so I had one of the mutations. I had BRAF mutation, which brought up Tafinlar and Mekinist. So the oral immunotherapy drugs, and those are what worked. The closing out of the Opdivo and Yervoy actually just about killed me and thankfully didn't. And just long enough where the oral immunotherapy drugs worked great within a couple of weeks. And then I think I finished out Keytruda. And the whole thing was about 2 years from around October of 16 through about December of 18. I think when they gave me the you don't get a cured definition, I guess, but you know no evidence of disease, I think is what they call it on the. But the interesting thing with that was what was described earlier, what Sanjay was talking about, was I made the mistake of looking online at some of the, you know, cancer.org and
don't do that
statistics. Well, it was such a I've had cancer. I had retinoblast summer when I was a child, and so had an eye removed from that, and you know, thankfully have vision and functioning in most ways as a human being, I guess, not resulting of that really. But so I think this was a secondary cancer. So children with cancer or adults with cancer is the, so my oncologist indicated that's most likely what this was a result of. But yeah, I looked at the statistics and, you know, like the 5-year survival rate was maybe like 20%. And I think like the 10-year survival rate was like under 10, maybe, or under 15.
Oh, gee.
Not awesome. But they were looking at me kind of grim when I got the diagnosis, when they first took the, when I had my my follow-up appointment with my neuro-oncologist. And I was just thinking, what are we going to do? And like, we'll just go through some stuff and everything will be okay. And, you know, they didn't have that look on their face.
Oh, no. Yeah.
That just really wasn't where they were at. And they're like, well, this is something we can manage, but not likely that success wasn't real high on their list. Yeah. So, sure.
So you really are a success story.
Yeah. I think my, my oncologist, so I have the unique perspective now of I work for the hospital system now that treated me.
Oh, and wow. Okay. That's
so awesome. I was actually up until a couple of months ago, I was a principal trainer for the LIS system that the lab uses, and they're changing to another one. And I'm the head of the training element for that project. So I know all these people, both as my clinicians, as well as now on the back end of this process. It's really interesting.
I know, we just can't get away from the laboratory now. Now we snared him in.
I know.
Can we interest you in sending you back to school to become a medical technologist?
chemistry was part of why I didn't become an engineer. So I feel like I'm not going to be real great in that respect either.
We need good clinical informatics people. So thank you for doing what you do. And you know, part of what we're trying to do here at ASCP and what our entire profession as pathologists and laboratory professionals are trying to do are really to increase the visibility of our field, right? So people think about oncologists and they'll see their oncologist, whether it's the medical oncologist, the radiation oncologist, et cetera. But a lot of times people don't get to meet the folks in the lab you have through your professional activities. But a lot of times people don't even realize that we are there doing all that we do, and that someone looked at the biopsy that you had that made this diagnosis and ran undoubtedly special stains on it, this and that, to make sure your diagnosis was correct, which then initiated the treatment, you know, and had they took a lot of expertise and training for them to do that. And everything starts with the correct diagnosis, right? So prior to your working within the laboratory, working with the LIS implementation, and again, thanks for that, did you ever have an opportunity or any interest in the laboratory or meeting with the pathologist to discuss the results, et cetera?
No, I don't know that I didn't really have an interest. I just never really thought about it.
Yeah,
probably exactly. Like a lot of people probably are just isn't really in your frame of mind. Other than, you know, the people that set my IVs when I went in for therapy mm-hmm. visits and all that, like I never really, you know, the phlebotomists and that, you know, they're the person you actually see, right? But
right.
Yeah, that was phlebotomy was about the only place that I've really interacted with anybody.
Yeah, and I think that's true for 98% of the population.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I saw the pathology reports, I guess. But
right.
You know. Right. And then you're like, well, this is all Greek and Latin. I need help parsing what all of this means.
Yeah, just looking for the keyword, you know, indicators of right. You know, like something new or whatever. No, you know, like it always said no evidence of or whatever, or if it
right.
said new
evidence,
you're like
yeah.
flag words. Yeah.
So looking back on it retrospectively, how could a pathologist or someone in the laboratory have helped you on your journey?
I've been thinking about that. You know, I think that's part of why I got involved in this role of this, you know, patient champion side is I think having just, if nothing else, an appreciation of that person. I don't know that me talking to them would have maybe done a lot. At the time, at least, my level of understanding wasn't real high. It still isn't super high. But I think it would have been interesting at least to see the kind of what's happening behind the curtain, at least understanding some more statistic kind of stuff behind it and some of the things that they're doing and like what they're looking at. My oncologist did a really good job of a lot of that too. I mean, he's a pretty fantastic human being just overall in the way that, you know, went through the whole treatment process and explaining things. But, you know, looking at that as a care team and involving them in that overall umbrella of your care team would have been pretty interesting to see that.
Yeah, I know that there are several institutions. It's not super widespread yet, but there are a handful of institutions in the States anyway that they're implementing pathologists on the clinical care teams, where, you know, the pathologist is involved with those meetings and you can ask them questions about your condition and all of that. So I think that's helpful. You know, I think if it were me and I weren't in the laboratory or involved in the profession in any way, if I were diagnosed with something, I'd want to know, like, okay, cool, like, how did you know that? I'm going to swing back here and get into a little bit of the nitty-gritties of the actual diagnoses. Sanjay and Lynette, what kind of biomarker testing are you guys currently performing for non-small cell lung carcinoma and melanoma? Are these kind of ordered at particular stages or in certain clinical settings? Do you perform testing, figure out what sort of immunotherapy they should be doing? Or I guess basically just tell me everything about this testing.
Who wants to go first? Sanjay, do you want to go first?
I'll take a shot at it, Lynette. And then
okay.
You can, why don't you fill in the gaps that I leave out of the thing?
Okay. Sure.
Does that sound good?
That's great.
Okay. So, you know, I'll tackle the lung cancer thing first. You know, what happens typically from the diagnosis point of view is once the bronchoscopist or the radiologist, whoever is actually doing a biopsy on the patient's tumor or suspected tumor, takes a piece of that tissue and sends it to the lab. It gets processed by histotechnologists and lab people. So there's a lot of, you know, behind the scenes people who are involved to get a slide made and sent to the pathologist. And then the pathologist is the first person who figures out, yes, this is cancer or no, that's not cancer. So that's a huge part of the pathologist's job. Is it even cancer to begin with? If not, what it is? Is it a, you know, infection of some kind? And then if it is cancer, so in lung cancer, there's a big thing in lung as to what kind of cancer it is and whether treatment, you know, testing is even required in that kind of cancer. So let's say I said this patient has a carcinoid tumor. That would be relatively good news. That would not need all this kind of extra testing. And then it would go to some kind of an algorithm, which usually involves surgery. But if I involve, you know, identify a special kind of cancer, which we call non-small cell lung cancer. It's funny because it has a non in the name, like a non-vegetarian, you know, it's like an oddly framed diagnosis. But it's called non-small cell lung cancer. So in that, I try to figure out what kind of cancer it is. And let's say I come down to, with my, you know, observations, I say, this is an adenocarcinoma of the lung. At that point, I make a decision that this needs testing. So in the US, this happens differently in different hospitals. In some places, the pathologist makes the decision to test. In some places, the pathologist issues the diagnosis and then the clinician, the patient's doctor, you know, the oncologist makes the decision to test. So who makes the decision to test, you know, changes the workflow a lot. So in my hospital, I make the decision to test. The testing gets emailed to my molecular pathology division, and then they take over testing from there. So they do all these next generation sequencing tests. They do FISH testing, they do immunohistochemistry, and they do PD-L1, all of them ordered by me based on my decision that this is the appropriate kind of case to test. And from there, you know, it takes about 10 days or so, 10 working days for all that very, very complicated and intense testing to happen. And then we get a whole lot of genes and there's results whether this gene mutation is present or not. And then us, the pathologists, we read the patient's PD-L1 status based on immunohistochemistry. And at the end of the day, when the patient goes back to see the doctor in, let's say, 3 weeks, at that point, the oncologist already has all this information in their hands. So they know the PD-L1 result. They know all the molecular testing results. So if you wait and if the pathologist doesn't initiate testing, then the oncologist has to keep track of, you know, what kind of cancer and all that. And so it delays by a little bit, you know, initiation of therapy. So that's how it goes from the lung cancer point.
Yeah, this reflexive testing definitely is more patient-centric. I mean, but I know not every organization is able to or has the, you know, Cleveland Clinic's a big place, you know, and I think a lot of smaller practices or community hospitals may not have that algorithm in place where the testing is ordered up front, which then, of course, delays when patients are able to receive testing. And maybe even some patients slip through the cracks and don't have testing that they're eligible for, which if you think about like Jim's instance, had he not known that he had that BRAF mutation, I mean, life would have been a lot different. You know, it's just sort of scary to think. So, Lynette, do you guys do reflexive testing in your shop too?
We don't, but it is expedited. So in our organization, we have a multidisciplinary team made out of members from pathology, from oncology, pulmonology in the case of lung cancer, where we as a group go over the recommendations that are out there from the CAP, for example, for testing, like what are we testing for the mutations or for immunotherapies. And we have an order set that has been developed that we use in our information system and in our hospital medical record, where oncologists then the tests that we have all deemed appropriate for the given type of cancer are orderable by the oncologist. So once they get the results, they can send those orders in. We all expect that they're coming. We've agreed on what's testing. So there's no back and forth between, you know, the efficacy of a test or should this be performed for this particular tumor. And then it gets sent out. And of course, what is ordered depends on the stage of the disease and whatnot. But other than that, it's very much like what Sanjay described in his experience.
Because I know for a lot of folks, sometimes it's an issue with not knowing what the stage is, right? So someone might say, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, well, I see I have this diagnosis of a lung adenocarcinoma or of melanoma if you have the skin lesion, but I don't know what the stage is, so I don't know whether it's appropriate to order these or not, or if this is a more early stage lesion. So how do you guys, I guess, Lynette, that the tumor board discussion helps with that. Sanjay, how do you get around that?
Yeah, that's a very good point, Ali. I mean, that was initially why people said we shouldn't be doing this because we don't know what the stage is. So what our oncologists, they made a decision of quite a long time back now. It's been several years, actually. They said that we should actually ignore the stage and just test everybody. And they said, you know, what's coming down the line is that you're going to be needing this testing in early stage patients too. And we are willing to take the risk that we are over-testing some patients who won't need the results than to delay testing for those who do need the results. So yes, we were actually, I think we were probably testing, you know, at least the early stage patients, we were probably over-testing them and they didn't necessarily need it. But that's changing now, Ali, and that's kind of an interesting thing that's changing now, is that at least for some patients with early stage disease, you actually do need molecular testing. So you do need EGFR and ALK for giving a certain drug combination, which is called the CheckMate 816 trial. So you need to make sure that the EGFR and ALK is negative before they get their chemoimmunotherapy combination for neoadjuvant therapy. That means therapy before the surgery. So that's a very hot off the press, like recent development that we've discovered that this therapy works better for patients who are going to get their surgery. So they give neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy. The breast people know this well, I know, but for lung, this is a new thing. You know, that neoadjuvant therapy didn't used to be effective before, but now it is. So that's a big game changer in our field. And now we have two more trials. One is in EGFR, where we know that patients who are resected actually do have, there's a trial called ADORA that shows that patients who are resected, early stage tumors, who have EGFR positive tumors actually benefit from giving adjuvant therapy. So therapy after the tumor is resected. That's another rationale for testing. And now I hear from a very, very recent trial that there is such a thing coming for ALK as well. So there is evidence that even for ALK, testing in early stage might actually influence who gets treated. So the short answer is, yes, testing used to be indicated only for advanced stage patients, but we are testing everybody at the risk of overtesting a little bit. And I think this is going to change in that early stage patients will also need testing for various reasons.
Yeah, the neoadjuvant thing is super cool. You know, of course, we've been doing it as a breast pathologist, we've been doing it breast cancer for a long time, and having a way to be able to say, oh, well, maybe this therapy is working or it's not working, and you can switch gears or continue with the same, or like with Jim, where his initial therapy was not tolerated, you know, it just wasn't even an option to keep on with. It's just so much better for patients. I'm sorry, Lynette, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that when we don't have patients we don't know the stage of a patient, I should say, that we would do the same thing. We would err on the side of caution and over-test versus under-test as well.
So what happens with that? Especially I'll ask Lynette, my friend who does a lot of administration. If that is indeed the case, and the payer doesn't pay for this testing, this is very expensive testing. And I'm sure Jim is no stranger to medical bills and having to deal with all of that. You know, we want the patients to have every opportunity they can to receive the best, most cutting edge treatments. However, we also don't want to surprise bill them with some horrible barrage of molecular tests that are very, very difficult to pay for. So how do your organizations reconcile that?
Well, luckily, because we've done a good job of determining what should be tested based on guidelines, almost all of our payers are paying for these tests. I think where we struggle sometimes are when we're at stage four, end of life, where we're doing like next generation sequencing, and some of those are not always paid for. But for most of the tests that we're talking about today, you know, we're lucky enough. I think where we get challenged sometimes is that sometimes reference labs that we partner with don't always know how to do the billing, and we get challenged with that. And as you know, Allie, we're looking at different models of potentially laboratory professionals that might be able to fill a niche in organizations that may not be as lucky, or they don't have the resources that as we've talked about before, to really have somebody that gets and knows these billing issues or some of these other, you know, just workflow. It's really a dance. When we get that diagnosis and we know that we have to do molecular testing for targeted therapies and immunotherapies, it is definitely a coordination of what laboratory partner if we're not doing the testing in-house. Some people do them in-house, but a lot of places don't. So, you know, what lab partner are we going to use? How do they bill the patient? Is it institutional billing? Are they going to bill us? Are they going to third-party bills? We think that they should, you know, that could probably be a whole nother topic. You know, are we sending them the right tissue? Do we have a process in place for our pathologists to choose the appropriate representative sample to send to these testing laboratories? Are we making sure as an organization that if a prior authorization is needed for a patient to get billed, that that is getting completed before testing is, you know, samples are sent to the testing lab? So it is quite the coordination, and we've, you know, found ways to do it well, but we still have gaps where I think we could do better. And because, as Sanjay was mentioning, things are changing all the time. Now you hear about what's happening with these early stage diseases. Well, now we've got to pivot, because now we've got to be ready for this type of testing on this type of tissue for this type of patient. So it's ever changing.
Yeah. Jim, from a patient standpoint, how do you feel about this? I mean, obviously for the tumor that you had, the fact that you had that mutation really was imperative. I mean, we don't even want to think about the alternative. So having had that appropriate testing really changed your life. How do you feel about this? Like it's hard for the understanding how it's hard for the lab to figure out and not wanting patients to be burdened with costs, but still wanting to deliver that appropriate testing that could be really the linchpin for a cure or for remission.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's probably a fine line. I mean, I look back at, you know, from like December of 15, when I started exhibiting symptoms, this mass that was growing in the mediastinum was what was cutting off blood flow, is causing the swelling from, you know, my knees through down my feet. And I think of, you know, they ran EKGs like two or three times. Like, I think I had like a chest X-ray, but not like a PET scan or an MRI or maybe even a CT that probably would have showed that. Drastically more expensive tests, right? When we talk about the former versus the latter. But what's your outcome? Like, and I'm not Monday morning quarterbacking it, but I mean, I guess in the same vein, if we look at, if you can justify, you know, where it's going, and I'm in my case, it's pretty easy to justify again, you know, in the post sense, but I mean, at the time when they got the results back, the Opdivo, I think we had stopped because it wasn't quite less than effective. It was actually causing more problems than it was solving. And then there was active growth still in that mediastinum area, which was starting to cut off my windpipe. So I don't know how much longer that probably could have gone. So I think at that point, like, it probably would have been a pretty easy case for you to say, we want to run this testing. And I don't know that I would have questioned a lot what the cost of it was. So, I mean, I guess it's more of an individual decision though, because, you know, everybody's going to have their own views on that. Like, I wouldn't want to make that choice for someone else. So, I don't know. Not a real definitive answer. I'm sorry, but that's...
But thank you for your perspective. That's great.
Can I jump in, Ali? Because I actually very much empathize with Jim's situation. I think that's the situation many patients are in, is they are desperately sick. You know, the thing is very advanced. You know, sometimes it is affecting vital function. And at that point, when a hospital, when an oncologist, when a healthcare system is talking to the patient, I think, you know, talking about billing and the niceties of, you know, the pathology lab's workflow, it just doesn't resonate as much as we need to start treatment now. So, you know, I think that so much overrides the overall situation. I feel that I'm by no means an expert on billing. I know, actually, I don't know anything about billing. but my sense is that the pathology is a very small fraction of the overall cost of treating a cancer patient, and that healthcare systems might be in some cases willing to eat that cost so that treatment can start quickly and patients can be satisfied. And, you know, treatment is not halted just because testing wasn't started. I think there's some of that going on in these decisions, is the need to start treatment quickly.
I'd agree with that. And I think, you know, what we've been trying to work on with these workflows and the things that I've been working on with Ali and some of the team at ASCP is, how do we do this better? How do we do it faster? How do we do our part in a more synchronized way so that we can get treatments and decisions to patients faster when they need it so urgently? Because as I mentioned, the workflow can be kind of cumbersome in our little piece of this. And we know that there's opportunity for us to do even better.
So let me, we're kind of segueing into a question I wanted to ask you guys, which is, how do the pathologists and the laboratory professionals work with oncologists and surgeons to improve patient care for these patients? I mean, Sanjay, like you were saying, it's a lot of it is speedy diagnosis, but is there anything else we do in the laboratory that helps them do their thing?
Oh, yes.
I mean, other than providing the diagnosis. I just walked into that one. Yeah.
yes. Providing that. I mean, there's so many things in lung cancer. And I think in melanoma too, you know, there's just so much that we do that helps the clinician. Not just diagnosis, but then, you know, saying, is this lung cancer or cancer coming from another place, metastasizing to the lung? That's one thing we do. Then telling them, you know, is this an aggressive lung cancer that's likely to kill the patient, or something low grade that a different therapy might be indicated? And then choosing which kind of, you know, testing to do. For example, if I have a squamous cell carcinoma, I'll order a PD-L1, which will help for immunotherapy down the line. If there's adenocarcinoma, I'll do the testing that I mentioned before, which includes EGFR, ALK, KRAS, BRAF, and all those things, plus PD-L1. Then for patients who are not advanced, so not Jim's situation, but patients who have less advanced cancer, you know, let's say it's limited to the lung, or just lung plus a lymph node in the chest, but no further than that. For them, we do a lot more other stuff, because then those patients get resected. So their whole cancer comes out. Then we tell them, you know, what is the stage of this cancer? Has it gone into the lymph nodes? If it goes to the lymph nodes, those patients need to get additional therapy, which is called adjuvant therapy. So there's a lot of work from the pathologists on that side, you know, on the resected lung cancer side, which are not quite as advanced. And then we work with oncologists and radiation oncologists and other proceduralists at tumor boards. So tumor boards are now, you know, standard practice in virtually every institution, where we go and sit around a table. Everybody discusses the patient's cancer. All the experts are there and they're bouncing questions off each other. They go, you know, Jim has this and, you know, should we give him Yervoy? Should we give him, treatment that's targeted to his BRAF mutation, or should we give him immunotherapy? Now his immunotherapy is causing him side effects. There's this hemophagocytic syndrome. Should we stop the drug? How long should we stop it for? So there's all these discussions that need to be made that the experts discuss and that pathologists are, you know, consulted at every step of the way, because we have seen the tissue and we know more about the cancer than anybody else. So that, I think, we contribute in that way to every step of the patient's treatment.
Yeah, we touched on quite a bit also about like doing unnecessary testing or the risk of doing unnecessary testing from a financial standpoint, et cetera. But I think it's just really important to mention, even more importantly, that we ensure that patients who should get the testing do get the testing, and that it's not that there's a patient that should be, you know, afforded this testing and then they fall through the cracks. You know, there's some sort of, it's not reflexive and someone has to order it and they don't come for follow-up or whatever, the myriad of post-analytical errors that could happen with a patient. And so Sanjay, the way that your workflow is that you're going to order it up front regardless. You're not waiting for anyone. Yes. And then Lynette, it seems like all of your patients are going to be presented in some sort of multidisciplinary tumor board format, hopefully. And then that's going to get ordered on the back end. I don't know if you guys have any comments on that, because that's almost, to me, worse, that if you could have had, I'd much rather have to pay for testing I didn't need than not have had the testing that would have saved my life.
Yes, actually, I do have two things to say on that, Ali. You bring up two very good points. And one is on the side of missing potentially targetable therapies, right? So let's say the patient has an ALK mutation, you miss it. So does that actually happen in real life? So there are actually studies from the oncology side that show that does happen a lot. Mm-hmm. In a unconscionable number of cases where you could have tested and potentially found something, their patients are not tested for many reasons. And that could be in oncology, in pathology, in the, you know, post-diagnosis oncology side, nursing, you know, technicians. There's so many people involved that lack of testing could happen at any step there. The other thing I wanted to mention is that on the side of testing itself, there is so much involved. These are very tiny specimens. You know, everybody in this talk knows, and probably Jim too, that these are very small pieces of tissue. I mean, they're literally the size of the tip of a pencil, you know, very small pieces of tissue. And we are doing dozens of tests on these. So the amount of coordination that it requires to figure out how to do that between us and cytologists and bronchoscopists, it's really a mammoth operation. I mean, behind one patient's diagnosis, there are probably, I would say, easily 24 lab professionals working behind one patient, easily behind one patient's one diagnosis on one patient. So it's really a gigantic operation.
Yeah, and I just to clarify, not all of our patients will hit the tumor board, but we do have a multidisciplinary team that helps determine what tests we provide to our patients that are coming through. And we do that in multiple specialties, not just for lung cancer. But, you know, to your point, Sanjay, it is really something we've tried to focus on. I mentioned earlier when we've talked about screening, you know, how do we make sure we're not missing those patients? You know, I grew up as a cytologist, so cervical cancer screening is, you know, near and dear to my heart. And now as I see them starting to do it for other cancers like lung and like other things, when we talk about melanoma and we used to talk about, you know, doing skin checks and things, everything that we can do to help, you know, get out there and get the word out. You know, advocacy is a big thing that we talk about a lot, and having patients like Jim join us to be a patient advocate to help us remove those barriers, especially, you know, cultural barriers are a big thing where I live. You know, we have a very large population of Hmong and Somali, and it may not always be in their culture. And so how do we as a health system get out there and help make sure that these other populations that may be underscreened and underrepresented are getting in here and getting equitable access as well? So, you know, as you mentioned, just mammoth undertaking and, you know, just trying to continue to chip away at it, you know, day after day as testing and treatments get better.
So you guys talked a little bit about like creating algorithms and stuff for testing, you know, in your cascade, right? Like a diagnostic cascade. What are some of the challenges for the providing the laboratory services or support for biomarker testing? You know, like obviously if you refine your workflow, that can help get a faster diagnosis. Are there any considerations related to equitable access, like Lynette was saying, for patients to biomarker testing?
I'm not sure. Lynette, do you want to take that? I'm not sure if there's issues on that side here.
I'm not sure if, I think there are challenges. I don't know if they're necessarily always within the health system. I think getting those patients into being seen and screened, I think getting them into the system is probably where our barriers are. I can say in the beginning, when we first started doing these tests, I think there was a lot of confusion, even from the oncologist, of which one to order. Like, what ELK am I ordering? What BRAF am I ordering? And so we've done a lot of work around those order sets, like I said, to make sure we're ordering the correct one for this particular tumor type. And, you know, that is a challenge because they're going to continue to change. So knowing we have people like Sanjay, like who's a pathologist, who's obviously passionate about this, who can help us make those decisions, or, you know, whoever your champion is, to make sure that we're on top of these things and that we're able to pivot quickly when testing algorithms recommendations change. I think that's a big thing. I think the other thing that I am challenged with this, is that what does our data look like? Like, we send out a lot of our molecular testing, almost all of it. And do we really know what our turnaround times are, and can we do better? Are we looking at our insufficient rates? So how often are we sending biopsies to that reference laboratory and they're not able to get testing off that little tiny biopsy like we were talking about? Can we do better in collection? We've done studies in-house where we've improved our biopsy collection, so we make sure we have enough tumor in those little biopsies so they get tested. I would say that is probably where some of our biggest challenges are just making sure that we have the, you know, the right test ordered, that the turnaround, something doesn't get hung up in all of these handoffs, and that we have, you know, we have enough tumor in those biopsies to make the diagnoses based on all these tests we're trying to perform on it.
Yeah, being a good steward of the tissue, mm-hmm. You know, like for instance, Jim, with your tumors, I mean, brain and mediastinum, we don't want to have to go back mm-hmm. there, right? We want to go for that biopsy once. Not a pleasant procedure. I mean, even if it's like a breast biopsy, that's very unpleasant as well. But in an intracranial, something inside of your skull or inside of your thorax, you know, or, you know, lung biopsy, I mean, when I see something and there's not enough tissue or there's too much necrosis, it's heartbreaking because it's like, oh my gosh, I don't want this patient to have to go through this procedure again mm-hmm. just to have the biopsy. So being a good steward of the tissue, which Sanjay mentioned, can be as small as the tip of a pencil. It's no joke, you know?
Oh yeah, that irreplaceable specimen sticker always would kind of like make my heart seize a little bit, like, ah, don't screw this up.
It's not a blood draw. No. Just go back and get it. Yeah.
Yeah. Precisely.
Yeah, I think from our point of view, another problem is that, you know, there's a ton of problems with trying to do so much testing on so little tissue. But one of the problems we face in the lung is that the lung is also the site of metastatic disease from so many other things, right? Breast cancer, colon cancer. So pathologists are trying to simultaneously figure out that question. Is it primary lung cancer or metastasis? And, you know, you can do immunostains. You know, you can do 2 trays of immunostains. You can do 40 immunostains if you want to on that. But you can't, right? Because you have to save the tissue for all this important molecular testing. So there's that tension, the balance between how much do I do on the diagnostic end and how much do I keep for the therapeutic, which is, you know, it's a killer of a decision because you don't want to be wrong on either end. So it's very, very difficult for pathologists to do this with so little tissue. And you have to make, you know, very difficult judgment calls, especially in this kind of litigious atmosphere. You know, you don't want to make, first of all, you don't want to make a mistake for the patient's sake. And second, you don't want to expose anybody to any kind of, you know, litigation and all that. And that is very difficult to do when you have a small biopsy and limited, you know, limited tissue.
Yeah, you're constantly making the game time decision, right?
Yes.
I want to kind of wrap up our conversation this afternoon by asking Jim, from your perspective, I'm really interested to hear what you think patients should know about the laboratory team. Because like you said, right, before you got sick or whatever, you maybe didn't think about the laboratory so much, or even while you were in the hospital, you didn't think about the lab so much. You just knew that the phlebotomist was coming to draw your blood. Now, after everything you've been through, what do you think patients should know about the laboratory?
I think a lot of this comes from kind of that role that I've had in getting to know a lot of these people. And I think it really opened my perspective to how much clinical decision-making sits on top of something that came from the lab. And, you know, working for a hospital system, even outside of my own experience in seeing clinicians that are like, when's the next round of labs coming through? Like, why is this test taking so long? Like, what's the service level objective for whatever these testing is? Like, what's our turnaround time expectations? All these things that are thrown around, and realizing that there's a reason they're waiting for these things. There's a reason they're upset of why this is taking as long as it is, because they're trying to take care of this patient. And that decision that they're trying to make is based on that information that they don't have yet. And kind of what you highlighted earlier of like talking about delays in treatment and how, you know, a day or two can make a big difference in someone who's suffering or maybe doesn't have that many days for you to figure that out. So I'm just highlighting their involvement in this, and that it's not just oftentimes a lesser known area of a basement of a hospital. like
hey man, ours isn't. We have windows. Sometimes we have windows.
There's windows. Yeah. one of the health systems I worked in, they had a nice set of windows, but yeah, ours isn't in the basement, but there really is not. I don't know how many times I've walked through that hospital and never even knew that that's what that giant area was behind those doors. Mm-hmm. I had no idea. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you guys again so much for taking the time today to talk about this. This is a great conversation. And I hope that maybe some of the lay people out there that may be listening just really take to heart just how much the people that working in the laboratory care about getting the right diagnosis as fast as they can to patients. I mean, it's a driving force of what we do. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, the science is cool. This is cool. Cells are fun. And that's all true. But at the end of the day, we just want to provide the best patient care that we can. If you'd like to learn more about biomarker testing in melanoma and NSCLC, you can go to ASCP's immuno-oncology website, and I'll have a link for that up on the website once the podcast is live. Also, we wanted you to tell your colleagues about this podcast, and you can subscribe through your favorite podcast aggregator so you don't miss a future episode.
And don't forget, you can claim CME or CMLE credit for listening to our podcast for free by looking for Inside the Lab in the ASCP store on our website, which is www.ascp.org. Thanks to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Me.